Many millions of people around the world wake up each morning to face a tremendous struggle with an addiction. The pain and loss of human potential resulting from their various addictions is enormous. So today on Please Explain, we have decided to learn about what happens when someone becomes an addict and how those addictions might best be treated. Joining me now is Dr. Sanjay Gupta, a practicing neurosurgeon and the chief medical correspondent for the Health and Medical Unit at CNN. He is the anchor of the weekly program House Call, and his most recent documentary, CNN Presents Addiction, Life on the Edge, will air this Saturday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
And, of course, we will be taking your calls at 212-433-9692 later. You can also send us a comment on our show page at wnyc.org. Dr. Gupta, we usually open these Please Explain segments with the basics. So can you give us a scientist's definition of addiction?
The addiction that we sort of have really tried to investigate in this documentary focuses on some specific changes that occur in the body and the brain. When someone is exposed to a substance, they have a change in the brain that may cause a sense of euphoria that is exponentially higher in the addict's brain as compared to someone who's not an addict. And they also have profound withdrawal symptoms if they stop using the substance. And that is sort of the scientific basis of their addiction. It raised a lot of interesting questions. I think, you know, to take it a step further, when you ask, is addiction somehow a lack of willpower, a lack of moral fortitude of some way, or is it thought of better as a brain disease? And that is a debate that rages. There is no absolute answer, Leonard, to that right now.
Well, in watching your CNN program, one of the characters, actually somebody who had been on the show with his father, is constantly fighting his addictions, and he is somebody who has a lot of privilege, who seems to have all sorts of advantages that other people might not have, and yet he keeps on giving into his addictions, and it's hard not to be a little judgmental as you witness him.
Nick Sheff wrote the book Tweak based on his recovery, and in fact, when I first met him about a year ago, he was on a book tour talking about recovery, and he looked like the kind of guy, young guy, a talented guy who had beat addiction.
That's what I thought when he was here with his father.
That's right, and even during the making of this documentary over the last year, he relapsed on three separate occasions, literally in front of our eyes. At one point, he canceled out on interviews that we were trying to find him for the shootings, and he could not be found. What was interesting as well is that he sent us a letter, and he said, "I've come to the conclusion that I'm always going to be an addict. I may be a person who no longer uses drugs, but I will always be an addict." And I thought, in retrospect, that was a very profound thing for him to say.
Isn't that what AA tells alcoholics, that they're always an alcoholic even if they haven't had a drink for 30 years?
Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. That is the mantra. But I will tell you, that is being challenged in the scientific community. And if you go back to that original question, you ask, is addiction a disease of the brain? And the next time you look at an alcoholic or look at a drug addict and you look at them in the same way that you might look at someone who has diabetes, heart disease, or cancer, everything changes, Leonard. Your viewpoint, the way that you perceive that person changes, the medical treatment or other treatment the person's going to get is going to change, socially, psychologically, physically, everything changes.
So what is understood about what happens in the brain of a person who's addicted to a substance? In the show, you talk about three areas of the brain that are specifically identified as responding differently in addicts.
There is a pleasure-reward center of the brain. It's not an exact center, but it is sort of different areas of the brain that respond to pleasure and reward. Now, what is, you know, a lot of people have heard of the substance serotonin, for example. Antidepressants all work sort of based on this idea that you keep the serotonin around in the brain longer. Why? It makes people feel better. It's a feel-good neurotransmitter. That is important when talking about addiction as well, because there is a belief that in addicts, when they're exposed to their substance of choice, serotonin levels spike in the brain, and they get this profound sense of euphoria. And it is much higher, for example, in someone, an alcoholic who decides to take a drink versus a non-alcoholic who takes a drink. And I think that's part of what explains that this pleasure reward center seems to be out of whack is maybe a little too simplistic way of putting it, but it is. It's not functioning normally.
Can you give us a brief description of what happens in these three areas, the orbital frontal cortex, the amygdala, and both of which I had heard of, but I've never heard of the third one, the nucleus accumbens?
Yeah. So, there are hardly any specific centers of the brain that do a discrete thing. So orbital frontal cortex is an area of your brain that in part is responsible for your judgment. So you might know that you shouldn't do what you're about to do, and your orbital frontal cortex will kick in and you won't do it. If you're losing that part of your brain, your judgment seems to wane. So you become more impulsive, which a lot of people think is a component of addiction. The amygdala sort of are some of these memories. So you have this idea that it felt really good the last time that I drank or used, and it felt bad when I stopped using. And again, this gets back to that whole euphoria and accumbens thing. I'm sorry, euphoria and withdrawal thing. And then going to the accumbens, it is that sense of pleasure reward, that there is an area of the brain that sort of, again, isn't the seat or the center of pleasure reward, but it activates in a big way when someone who's an addict gets their substance of choice. So these three, the memory, the judgment, and the euphoria all sort of work in combination.
Does the nature of the substance make a difference? Does a methamphetamine addiction look different in the brain than an addiction to alcohol or to heroin?
It's a great question, and I think the right answer, based on looking at a lot of studies, is we don't know yet because we haven't had enough data. I mean, keep in mind that we're talking about a disease that up until very recently was diagnosed almost completely on a clinical basis, people getting asked questions, filling out questionnaires, taking surveys. How many drinks a day do you take? How much methamphetamine are you using? Why do you use? And now we're starting to get some of the first objective evidence of what addiction really is. And that's important because it is objective evidence, number one. And number two, what I think is incredibly exciting is someone who's treated successfully, you could see some of the brain changes start to occur. So you get objective evidence that it exists and objective evidence that it can be treated. But we don't know if methamphetamine is much different than someone who abuses methamphetamine, much different than an alcoholic.
Doesn't the body have built-in receptors for opiates, which led, because I remember speaking to a scientist, I think it was Eric Simon, who predicted endorphins just because he said, well, we have these receptors, the body must create its own opiates, and he named them endorphins, and sure enough, there it was.
Yeah, and these endorphins take all sorts of different forms. They are sort of feel-good hormones, which are a little different than neurotransmitters, for example, although they can bind in the same way that neurotransmitters do. Neurotransmitters are sort of regulated primarily in the brain. But the question that this raises are there a lot more receptors for these feel-good substances in the brain of an addict starting at birth? I mean, are they just born with the ability to experience euphoria in response to these substances that's different?
Which leads us to the question, is there an addictive personality?
Right. That's exactly right. And now, you know, it's interesting because most of the scientists that I talk to say they're cautious to use the term addictive personality. That's a term that gets thrown around a lot. But, I think people are cautious because it somehow gives the impression that they could be addicted to anything. While the scientists, as they sort of work through this methodically, they say, well, no, it's not that so much that they're addicted to everything. It's that certain substances seem to release these, again, I'm calling them these feel-good substances that give them the sense of euphoria. So it's not that they're addicted to everything, but they are capable of addiction to some things.
Well, we use the word addiction rather loosely at times. Somebody will say, I'm addicted to chocolate or I'm addicted to exercise, and then there's so-called sex addiction. Are those the same sorts of things?
I don't think so, although we don't know. This field is evolving in terms of how we study these things objectively. So if you look at a sex addict, for example, or even just a chronic smoker, is their brain somehow different, or are they getting the same interplay between the accumbens, the orbital frontal cortex, the amygdala that we were talking about earlier? I don't know. I do think that with substances like methamphetamine, for example, that you talked about earlier, I think it is more heightened than just about anything that these scientists have seen. It causes changes in the brain that no other substance that they've seen, at least, seems to cause.
One of the people in your CNN program is Lucy, who became addicted to alcohol at 11, wasn't it? How do we understand and explain something like that? I mean, when I was 11 years old, to me, alcohol, if I had even had it, would have tasted really disgusting.
Yeah, you know, it's a great question, and it some would say it, you know, Lucy was this was a circumstantial cause for her addiction. She was drinking at 11, she was smoking marijuana at 12, and she was a hardcore cocaine addict in her early teens. And part of the reason I really wanted to profile her, I think I have three children, and I wanted to understand what the parents of someone like Lucy feel like, you know, and what they do. I mean, it's hard to get into rehab. And then after rehab, if they relapse, what do you do? But why, you know, her no one else in her family was an addict, at least that we could find. So there didn't appear to be the environmental factors that sometimes play in some of these other young addicts. And so some would say this is an example of why some sort of genetic predisposition, how it takes hold. And well, Lucy's a good example of that.
Well, she had so many different addictions. Is the detox process different for alcohol addiction versus methamphetamine addiction?
You know, methamphetamine addiction is probably one of the most difficult because there's hardly anything to help with the detox process. When it comes to alcohol, there are clearly defined physical things that happen to the body. And we understand that now better than ever, I think. Delirium tremens, for example, is something that is frightening to watch. A person starts to shake uncontrollably. Their heart rate goes up. They sweat. They feel awful. They're nauseated. But you can control that better than ever before. And these are the withdrawal symptoms. But with methamphetamine, it's just very, very difficult to control those symptoms, which I think detoxing someone out of meth is less successful, which is why I think the relapse rate is much higher.
We have a call from Edward from Fort Greene, Brooklyn, that adds to this conversation. Edward?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about my understanding is that a large percentage of addicts are also bipolar, and I wanted to ask if you delve into that in your documentary and also what your thoughts are on that and how it relates to the kind of brain chemistry questions that you're asking or what you're exploring.
Thank you for that. There's a large correlation between mental illness of various types and addiction. To be perfectly honest, we didn't delve into it as much as I would have liked. We had a lot more than didn't make it into the documentary because I think that there is you really can't talk about one without talking about the other. But it does get back to this issue of the serotonin that I was talking about earlier.
Well, how much of this is self-medication if you're really unhappy with the way you're feeling? Wouldn't you take certain things to calm you down or to make you feel a little better?
That's exactly right. That's exactly what I was going to say. You know, in fact, all of the people that we profile in this documentary and in sort of the in-depth interviews that I did with them, when we really got to it, after an hour of interviewing them and really sort of trying to drill down on how it started, why it continued on, they all got to this point where they said they were trying to compensate for something that was missing in their lives. And if you took it a step further, there was this idea that they were self-medicating, trying to cover something up. And in this case, they picked various substances.
My guest is Dr. Sanjay Gupta of CNN, and in addition to his other programs, he has put together a documentary called CNN Presents Addiction Life on the Edge. So we thought it would be a good idea to have him come on and talk about addiction on today's Please Explain. We'll be back with your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Also be addressing some of the comments you've left on our show page. But first this. We're back with Dr. Sanjay Gupta, who escaped having to work in Washington and is still at CNN. And on this Saturday, that's tomorrow at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, a documentary that he has put together called CNN Presents Addiction, Life on the Edge will be aired. And we are talking about addiction on Please Explain today. Dr. Gupta, a listener left a comment on our show page. He says, I think it's a he, As a psychologist, I have treated addiction as learned maladaptive behavior or habits, helping individuals manage their impulses and needs, often including anger and dependency, in more functional ways. The same applies to people who overeat. What do you? How do you respond to that?
I think there are a lot of people who are successfully treated much in the way that the psychologist is describing. And in fact, a lot of the larger, well-regarded rehab centers across the country, such as Hazelden in Minnesota, Betty Ford, people have heard of these places, do focus primarily on counseling, the 12-step program, which a lot of people have heard about. But you know, having said that and having investigated this now for a year, I think what we're starting to learn, and perhaps this is the safe answer, is that it's often a combination of two things that help the most. The counseling along with medications like naltrexone. It's not for everybody. Let me be clear on that. But in people who just aren't having success with traditional rehab or counseling, a medication may be useful. These medications like the naltrexone go in there and they bind some of those feel-good receptors again, block them, if you will, so that when you take the drink, you take the substance, you're not going to get that sense of euphoria that you got before. And it's a controversial area, but I do think that as we learn more about this, we are going to see that there is a brain disease component of this that thankfully can be treated.
Some people resist that because they really want to see this as a moral issue.
Mm-hmm.
And they
have a hard time looking at addiction like they would someone with diabetes or cancer, and it's a complete cultural change, what we're talking about here in this documentary. But I think it's a discussion worth having. We haven't made a lot of progress in this discussion, I think, because we're caught up in some of the traditional cultural issues, and I think that we just have to have the look at all the science.
Paul from Norwalk, Connecticut, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I read a lot about this, and what I'm confused about those two chemicals. One is serotonin and another dopamine. I understand that they both give you pleasure. Can you explain, please, what's the difference?
They're both neurotransmitters. They both have different functions within the brain. I think serotonin, they both can give you pleasure, although dopamine is probably more associated with heightened awareness. It's also, incidentally, the neurotransmitter that becomes deficient, for example, in someone who has Parkinson's disease. A specific area of the brain becomes deficient in dopamine. Serotonin has become more well-known, I think, because it is a good target for a lot of these antidepressants. If you look at the name, scientific name for antidepressants, they are called SSRIs, which stands for selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. If you think about that word for a second, these are drugs that prevent serotonin from being taken up or absorbed. It leaves the serotonin sort of hanging around the brain longer because it's a feel-good hormone. But you're right, there is some redundancy in the functions of these neurotransmitters.
Thank you for
which one is more in addiction, more prevalent?
Well, we think the serotonin, although, you know, keep in mind, we're not measuring neurochemicals in the brain. Like you measure chemicals in the body by putting a needle in your vein and taking blood, we can't do the same thing in the brain. So a lot of what we're talking about is sort of inferred data or indirect data, and looking at areas of the brain that are particularly affected by these neurotransmitters, seeing if they light up, for example, on functional MRIs, and then making deductions based on that. So it's not an exact science, and the reality is it may not be relevant because if a medication works in terms of blocking this euphoria, regardless of which neurotransmitter it's targeting specifically, may not be as important.
Thank you so much for calling us. Robert from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, how you doing?
Hey, Robert.
I was a heroin addict for 25 years, and you know, I went to methadone clinics. It never worked for me, really, until I went to a pain clinic, found out that my spine had a lot of problems, and they prescribed for me fentanyl, Dilaudid, morphine, basically the same stuff I was using on the street, except it changed my life. I'm now working at a methadone clinic, teaching Bible classes, practicing my musical instruments 4 hours a day. I become a productive citizen. It's not the substance. It's the lifestyle. I don't have to chase around a bag of dope for 8 hours. I don't have to avoid the police. I get $3,000 worth of narcotics a month. I take it as prescribed, and everything is wonderful.
Well, I'm so glad that you're doing so much better, and that you've you know, obviously overcome this heroin addiction. It sounds like methadone, incidentally, is a substance a lot of people may have heard of, but it's chemically very similar to heroin.
Isn't it also addictive?
Addictive, but it's something that doctors use to sort of, in a way, wean, if you will, someone off heroin. So they're still activating the same receptors, much in the same way that morphine and fentanyl and Dilaudid, as he described, do as well. But you know, it's you are trading some substances for another. But the lifestyle issue that you bring up is an important one. I mean, this is a, you know, we have drug nation issues as well, and trying to purchase these things and living that lifestyle can be quite difficult for people.
There's a strong recidivism rate for people who have gone through rehab, and in many cases it's because they go back to the same neighborhood that they left in the first place, and they have the same friends, they have the same influences. But what about that? How effective is the 12-step program that was developed by Alcoholics Anonymous and has been adapted by so many other groups?
Well, that's a great question. Here's two things that are worth pointing out that I found out that were, I think, a little bit non-intuitive. First of all, relapse, according to a lot of these centers, is part of recovery. It is not seen as a failure, but in fact, it's seen as part of the whole recovery process. If you want numbers in terms of how effective, one question you have to ask first is, what does success mean? Does it mean that a person who is an alcoholic simply doesn't drink alcohol anymore at all? And that is how a lot of these programs define it. And Hazelden, which is a large rehab center, will say we are 53% effective in the first year. That's a great number or not a great number, depending on your perspective. A lot of other programs, including programs that use the medications like naltrexone, will say, well, wait a second. There is no bright line that clearly separates an alcoholic versus non-alcoholic. It is a continuum. You have the hardcore alcoholics, you have problem drinkers, you have social drinkers, and you have people who don't drink at all. If you can reduce the drinking to the point where it's no longer interfering with their way of life, no longer impacting their job, you know, they're able to be productive, then you've had success. And they define that as success as well in these medication programs. So it just depends on your terms here, and everyone will point that out.
In your documentary, you go to Hazelden and other rehab centers that cost a lot of money, $20,000 to $50,000 for a month of intensive rehabilitation. If the relapse rate is so high, that seems like throwing your money away.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, it became a little bit of a, I think, almost a joke in the media, because you see these celebrities going in and out of rehab so often, and people say, well, this doesn't work. It's almost more like a timeout for celebrities as opposed to an effective treatment program. But we wanted to take it one step further. And again, you know, 53%, poor number or a good number, depending on how you look at it. They will say that's actually not a bad number. And if they come back again, the numbers will go up. They'll have better success. And, you know, that relapse is part of their recovery. They have to go through that to get to a point where they're recovered.
Joe in Queens left a question on our show page. Does addiction to a substance like marijuana necessarily lead to an addiction to a substance more powerful because the receptors no longer respond to the less powerful substance? You had somebody, in fact, on your program who talked about marijuana as a gateway drug,
right?
Although many people dispute that.
I'm glad he asked that. I have not come to a conclusion on that. I, and it's funny because I really wanted to, but I'm not, and I think I would be overextending to say that we concluded that marijuana was or was not a gateway drug. You're right. One of our characters on the documentary really feels that it was. They started doing this at a young age, smoking marijuana, and eventually it led to the use of harder core drugs. And I asked the question specifically of this person and their doctor, and they said, absolutely, it's a gateway drug. But, you know, scientifically speaking, it's not that easy. You do have a lot of people who have used marijuana recreationally for years and years and have not gone on to use harder core drugs. So what I sort of took away from it is that it could be, but you're not in any way relegated to a lifetime of harder drug use if you smoke marijuana.
Is it any different than people who drink beer or drink wine and never become alcoholics, as opposed to people who beer winds up leading to serious alcoholism?
That's exactly right. And what was interesting to me, Leonard, we went to the NIAA, which is the National Institute on Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse, alcohol and alcohol abuse. And we said, how do you figure out who is likely to become an alcoholic? What, is there some way of knowing before the person's an alcoholic? And they said, well, after studying tens of thousands of people who are alcoholics and then tracing their life backwards, something started to emerge as a possible telltale sign. And it might be shocking or surprising, at least, to people to hear this. And what they found was that for a man, if they had had four standard drinks on any given day of the year within the past year, or a woman who had had three standard drinks on any given day of the year, they were in the top 20 percentile of people who were going to go on to become addicts at some point in life. Now, it doesn't mean they will, but they would be flagged by a primary care doctor, by some sort of first line of defense to say, four drinks,
wow,
that's a lot. That shows.
That seems like a little bit.
It doesn't. And so for a lot of people, they say, well, wait, four drinks. I mean, nah, I'm not at risk for being an alcoholic. What does that mean exactly? Does it mean they have they've demonstrated some compulsion, some impulsiveness, some ability to drink a lot that is just a red flag for their doctors? Most of them obviously won't go on to be alcoholics. But the real key is trying to prevent it in the first place.
We have very little time, but I wanted to sneak Andrew in. Andrew from Jersey City. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. Love the show. I just wanted to say it's great, everything that you're talking about. And in all of the talk about what's going on in your brain and how this happens and everything like that, I just want to boil down like one point, which is it's so important for people to take notice of the paradigm shift and know that alcoholism and addiction, I've been sober for 12 years, and alcoholism and addiction is not a moral question, it's a medical question. It's like depression, it's not a disgrace, it's a disease. We're not bad people trying to be good, we are sick people trying to get well, and that can take many different forms in terms of a 12-step program, in terms of some meds, in terms of combination of things. But I just really want to stress that we're not evil people. You know, we do the best we can. We have these diseases that get the better of us and lead us to perhaps immoral behavior, but it doesn't start there. And I just want to make a plug really quick for 12-step programs. We're not God freaks. If you come to an AA meeting and you're freaked out by it, go to another one. Give it a try. They work so well. Thank you for giving me the time, Leonard. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for calling, Andrew.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, it's
that is a problem with some people, that there is the religious component, and but that Andrew's suggesting that shouldn't be a reason to turn you off.
There is a Andrew's describing this very well, because as we started working on the documentary, we heard a lot of that as well, and again, it may be the safe thing to say that there is a more objective evidence that there is a disease component to addiction than ever before. I think we just didn't have the data that we now get. As a neuroscientist, which is my background, that was where I was most interested, not because I was trying to answer some question about moral failures versus diseases, but because we can peer into the brain in a way that we've never been able to do, and I can say, look what happened here in this particular addict's brain, and more importantly, look what happens when they were successfully treated. A lot of things change there, and I think that's really fascinating. It gives credence to this idea that it's a disease.
Dr. Sanjay Gupta is a practicing neurosurgeon, chief medical correspondent for the health and medical unit at CNN, anchor of the weekly program House Call, and also the recent documentary CNN Presents Addiction Life on the Edge, this tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, and can I add that I'm a big fan of your show as well.